Good evening, everyone. And welcome.
I'm not dancing, if that's what you think's going to happen.
There's some room in the front if you feel like moving.
I do feel like moving, but not in front of everyone.
You've got to hold back.
Friends,
you're very welcome. And it's my wonderful privilege this evening to give a warm welcome to our guest, conversationalist tonight, Karina Hearn. Karina, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
Karina, you're in front of friends tonight. We're all friends, and we're just going to have a chat. And they're going to just listen in as you and I have a chat.
Okay. Sounds good.
I suppose the beginning of a conversation should be where it all started for you. And it started just out the road, just beyond Dunmurray, I believe.
Lisburn to start with.
Lisburn.
Yeah.
And there we have little Karina. Little Karina, yeah. And this other child with you here.
Yes, I asked my mum to send me some photos. This is what she sent me. So I was quite relieved. It wasn't like photos from the bath or something. So myself and my brother Gareth, we grew up in Lisburn with my mum and dad, Vera and David. And yeah, had a very happy childhood.
What do you remember most about that house growing up with Gareth?
Gareth and I had a bit of a love-hate relationship. We would have teased each other a lot. So, you know, there was a lot of play fighting went on, but we were really good friends as well. So great fun together. It was nice having his company. And mum and dad gave us lots of experiences, you know, a chance to travel and to see different parts of the world. And they raised us in a Christian home as well. So, yeah.
What did your dad work at?
So my dad was a lecturer in Lisburn Tech, and mum was a teacher in Harmony Hill Primary School. So,
and that's where you went, Harmony Hill.
Yep, that was my primary school.
Yeah.
It was strange having your mum as a teacher in the school because you couldn't get away with anything. You know, it was always told in the staff room at break time or lunchtime. So
yeah, and from Harmony Hill, you went to Wallace High.
Yeah. Went to Wallace and just loved my time at Wallace, and especially loved all different subjects, but especially loved studying languages, French at that stage, because there was no Spanish in Wallace at that time. But that's when I first got a love for languages, really. Okay. Yeah.
And you were telling me just before we started that you played music also at that time.
I did, yes. Quite badly, yeah. I was a cellist.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So you played the cello and in an orchestra, school orchestra?
Yeah, school orchestra, and which I did play in, and then an orchestra in Ballnahinch, which I mimed in very successfully because there was more cellists around, so you could do that. But we had some fun times, and I was sharing with Father Peter earlier that it was through orchestra that I had a chance to meet people from different backgrounds, which was great. And that's where I met my first friend, who was from a Catholic background, called Bruna, and we had a lovely friendship, and it was really interesting just hearing a little bit about her life and her faith as well.
This is yourself and your brother with mum and dad.
Yes. Yeah? It's a bit blurry, but the photo on the right was taken, I think, in Switzerland. And yeah, each summer we would go away somewhere different. Mum and dad have a caravan, they still do. And they love to, because they were both teachers, they got the summers off. So we got to go away over the summer and travel and just to explore new cultures, and I just loved going to France especially, but it was probably when I was around about 15 or 16 that I developed a real love for Spanish, because my brother had gone on an exchange trip to Spain, and that was the first year they did Spanish in Wallace. And my brother did an exchange with this family, and then the family came over and stayed with us. But I was really frustrated because my brother could speak to them in Spanish and I couldn't, and that really annoyed me that he could do it and I couldn't. So then I decided I wanted to learn Spanish as well, and I ended up studying it then at university, doing French and Spanish. And just love the idea of, you know, this whole new language and a whole way of communicating with people, and if you learn the code you can communicate, and that just really has always fascinated me. So
that was at Queen's, was it?
At Queen's.
French and Spanish.
French and Spanish together with a little bit of psychology as well.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And that would have given you an opportunity then to travel during those university years too?
Yes. I got a year abroad in the north of Spain and taught over there, and had the chance to work in a church when I was out there as well. Did interpretation. So if you think our sermons or homilies are long, you should try them being interpreted, because it was twice as long to get the interpretation done. Yeah. So the sermons could have lasted well over an hour, you know.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yes. Somebody said to me, coming out of Mass on Sunday, you know, and said, Father Peter, you said in 7 or 8 minutes what Presbyterians take 45 minutes to say. And my response was, well, you... Presbyterians get paid by the word.
Very good.
We get paid for the least words. The other way around, the upside down word. That's the upside Brilliant. Down word of sermons and homilies. So, but that was a great. Tell me, you met this wonderful gentleman here.
I did, yes. When I was at university, I met Barry when I was studying, and he was actually the CU leader for our subject area, and we were in small group together, and we met up, and as I say, I was part of the group, and one day I was sharing a prayer request that another friend had, and she'd passed it on to me, and she said her boyfriend was very ill and her boyfriend had a brain tumor, and could we pray for him? So I had brought this up at the small group, and during the small group I noticed that Barry wasn't paying attention. He seemed to be looking around at the ceiling and not listening. I couldn't understand why he wasn't, you know, giving it his full attention. So afterwards he said to me in private, after everyone left, he said, Karina, that guy that we were praying for, that's me. And I said, well, are you her boyfriend? And he said, no, but I have a brain tumour. I've just been diagnosed with a brain tumour. And so Barry and I actually started to meet up for coffee. I thought I'd upset him, and he thought he'd upset me by having that conversation. So we started meeting up for coffee and getting to know each other. And I came from a Pentecostal background, and the church that I went to, you know, was very, very big on, you know, praying for people to get healed. And if you have enough faith, the person will get healed. That was the belief at that time. And I really believed that God had crossed our paths for different reasons, but one of them was to give Barry encouragement that, you know, the Lord would heal him. So we got to know each other really well, and then after a while we started to go out with each other, and before long we had fallen in love, and it was a very special relationship. And he actually, Barry came to Spain as well, and we had that wonderful experience in Spain together too. But, you know, it wasn't to be that the Lord would heal Barry in this life. I do believe God's our healer, and God heals some people in this life, and he will heal all of those who are in heaven in the fullest sense when we're there. So I do believe God is our healer, but in this particular situation, it didn't turn out to be the Lord's plan to heal Barry. And so we were married for a year and 10 months. And when Barry passed away,
when that happened, you know, that decision, that journey that yourself and Barry had been on, and was there a lot of had to be a lot of nursing care as part of that, the last stages or anything?
Thankfully not. You know, okay. Barry was in he had epileptic attacks as part of his brain tumor, but apart from those, he was able to get about his everyday life right up until very, very close to the end. So, we had a real. I've got the music in the background, isn't that brilliant? We had a real sense that God was with us, even though we didn't understand what was God was doing in the situation, and God gave us a real sense of hope in him. And I remember one night, it was the night before Barry had his operation, and on that night, I remember I was in the hospital with him, and I was getting ready to leave him. You know, I was had wearing all these funny blue socks, you know, the blue slipper things you put on over your feet and all. And I remember sitting on the bathroom floor, and Barry was in the bedroom, and I had just started to cry, and because I knew that going into this operation, Barry may not have come out of it. And I remember just crying to God and saying, you know, how can we do this? How can we get through this? And I just had this real sense, you know, that God was saying, no matter what happens in the future, you know, I'm going to be in it. And the hymn came to mind, don't know if you know or not, but because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know he holds the future. Life is worth the living just because he lives. And it just gave me a real peace that no matter what was going to happen, God was going to be there, and the God was going to help, you know, in his way and according to his will. Mm-hmm. I suppose that, yeah, leads on to the verse that was...
And that was the reading from Joshua that meant so much to you at that time.
It really did. You know, we felt that this was a verse that God had given us when Barry was really ill. Joshua 1 verse 9, have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous, do not be afraid, do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. And in fact, we printed it out and we put it up above Barry's hospital bed, and we had a wee picture of a lion on it as well, remember? And any time either of us were getting a bit shaky, you know, we reminded ourselves of the verse. And one day the consultant, we were talking to the consultant, he was a Christian man, and we said to him, is there any hope? And he pointed at the verse and said, Karina, there's always hope. And I never forgot that, and very grateful to him for, you know, for encouraging us in our faith, even in the midst of such uncertainty.
So as a young wife, suddenly, you know, well, not suddenly, but, you know, less than 2 years, you find yourself alone and dealing with that aloneness and that big gap, that big hole in your life, you know.
Yeah, it's massive.
Yeah,
it just feels like your other half has been ripped away from you, and I felt like it was my better half that had been ripped away. So, and I also felt like, you know, Barry was in heaven, and I didn't want to be here. Really, life had sort of lost a lot of its sparkle and joy. It felt very grey, and I just wanted to be in heaven. I wanted to be with Barry and in heaven. I thought a lot about heaven, and you might know the wee phrase, so heavenly minded, no earthly use. That was what I was like a wee bit, you know. I just found it hard to continue in this world. But a part of the way I coped was, for a couple of months, I sort of tried to put my head in the sand and put on a brave Christian face, you know, that he's gone to be with the Lord, and, you know, that we have that hope in the Lord, and we do have that hope. But I was trying to put on a brave face to everybody, and wasn't really allowing myself the time to grieve. And then I met a counsellor one day, and he said to me, Karina, you just need to allow yourself time to grieve. You know, it's okay to be sad as a Christian. Yes, you have your hope, but it's okay to be sad as well and to grieve. And that was really helpful. So I began the healing process, really. And then that discovered Grief Share, bereavement support group. And all of a sudden I was with people who were, you know, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, who had lost spouses. But for the first time, somebody understood what I was going through, because all my friends weren't even married. I was married at 21, so my friends weren't even married, let alone widowed. So they couldn't understand. But so I made really good friends with some older folk at that stage who were wonderful support.
So it was through that shared experience and that knowing that you weren't alone.
Yeah, knowing you're not alone, and knowing that when you're with a group of people who understand, you don't have to explain everything. They kind of just know. They know what it's like. So you can just be yourself a wee bit more. And it was just really good to be able to share honestly with each other, and to be there to support each other. And we did fun things too. Like, we had a fancy dress night. So all these people who were deep in grief and going through a really difficult time. In the middle of the course, we had a night of like a little party night just to celebrate the joy and the blessings in our lives. And we came in fancy dress and it was totally ridiculous, but we all understood, you know, and nobody was judging anybody else. We were all just really pleased that we could actually have a little bit of happiness in our life despite the pain. So it was a really, it was a special group, and I do recommend it to others, the bereavement support group. Yeah.
Well, we're very pleased to have a support group within our own parish bereavement group.
Great.
And that's, we're very much aware of that need within our own parish ministry. So this was a passage from Isaiah that spoke very highly to you as well.
Yes, I probably got a little bit frustrated with God at one stage and was like, you know, I'd read these verses and, you know, especially the bit highlighted in blue, for your husband is your maker, the Lord of hosts is his name. And the first part there, do not be afraid, for you will not be put to shame. Do not be intimidated, for you will not be humiliated, for you will forget the shame of your youth and will remember no more the reproach of your widowhood, for your husband is your maker. And it, that those verses really spoke to me because I was widowed so young, and I did feel like, it wasn't like it was shameful, but it was very difficult to interact with other people your own age, and I didn't want to be in any relationships, you know, and it did feel like you were on your own a bit. And I felt like God was saying through these verses that the Lord would be like a husband to me. And although that was hard to understand how God could do that, I actually think that God provided for me, and there were lots of little things that God did at that time that that were, like the sort of things that you'd expect your nearest and dearest to do for you. So I'm very grateful to God for revealing that aspect of his character to me.
Okay. Yeah. Your closest friends at that time during that pain of loss, how were they with you? How did you?
My friends were tried their very best, and we'd have listened and tried to cheer me up too and take me out for meals and do things. Sometimes I didn't feel like it, and they were understanding. Like at the last minute, I maybe would have to say, look, I know you've organised this night out, but I can't do it. Yes, and they understood. So very grateful to them for being such a good listening ear, having such a good listening ear and being so understanding.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And accepting you just as you were any particular day, and just that's where Karina was.
Yeah, I'm not saying that they totally understood it, but they tried to.
We have some little shots here. There's two particular communities we're thinking about now.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned after Barry had died that that I started to think a lot more about heaven. And as I thought more about heaven, I thought about how, as followers of God, we'll all be together in heaven. And there's not all these divisions, you know. And I know that while we're on earth, that there are reasons for our divisions at times. But I thought in heaven, there's that wonderful unity. And I started to think I want to live that out in my life on earth and to reflect that. So I think that there are a few different groups that helped shape those thoughts for me. One was Summer Madness, and that's the picture on the right hand side, and being in Summer Madness with all the young people from loads of different denominations and backgrounds was amazing, and meeting leaders who were from Catholic and from different Protestant denominations as well was very, very formational for me. And then I also joined a group called, it was the student part of Caris Community. I'm not sure if you've heard of Caris. It's an ecumenical community in Belfast. And they would have, there would be other communities around the world which are part of Sword of the Spirit. And I got connected in with them, and through that group made some wonderful friends who were from Catholic and Orthodox background as well. So we even one year, I was telling Peter earlier, we made it over to World Youth Day to see the Pope, and that was a real cultural experience for me, I have to say. But it was a really wonderful time with all different nationalities.
And where was that?
It was in Cologne.
That's a huge gathering from all over the world, and as you say, different communities and nationalities, backgrounds, traditions, whatever, all coming together there.
And it really struck me how many young nuns and young priests there were. I couldn't get over it. Yeah. And there were tents set up for prayer, and young people were queuing to pray, and people were just sitting on the floor and just listening, reflecting on music and praying. And it was, yeah, a real sense of the Holy Spirit's presence there, which was wonderful to see and be part of. Yeah. And that kind of ties in with Teze, I suppose, the reflective music and just creating space to sit and to be with God, not always having to listen to big sermons or big Presbyterian sermons, but being able just to sit and reflect on the words and let them sink in and to create that space for intimacy with God.
That's the beauty of Teze. I had the privilege of being in Teze way back in 1973, in my first year in college. We spent Easter there, and I've always longed to go back, but that caught me at that time, that kind of reflective time through this mantra and chant that is very much part of the Teze music, you know.
Yes.
And it brings people together of all sorts of communities and all sorts of backgrounds, because somehow it seems to touch the heart.
Yeah, you know? It does, yeah.
It touches us where we are. Yeah. It was because of that, you know, this awareness of different communities, different faith backgrounds, reflecting on this wonderful prayer of Jesus the night before he's put to death, and he's at prayer. And what does that say to you?
I just think that, you know, for Jesus to have prayed that time, it was something that was really important to Jesus and important for us in our mission and in sharing God's love with the world, you know, to be as one. And so it's something that I've always felt it's been really important in ministry to try and create spaces, no matter, you know, wherever we are, whoever we're connected to in our life, to try and, to the best of our ability, to demonstrate that friendship and that oneness with others. And yes, we may not all agree on the same, you know, points of doctrine or whatever, but we've got those central things in common, those central pillars. And if we can show that to the world, then I think that speaks volumes. So I've always tried to live by that wherever I've been in ministry.
You were down in
Le Memorial Finicky, yes.
For a while. Mm-hmm. You were involved in, was it youth ministry, was it?
I started off as a teacher, teaching French and Spanish. But I really felt that God was calling me to work within church or missionary work or some.
Yes.
And I kind of thought, I was very aware of the brevity of life. And I thought, well, you've got to make every day count. And, you know, I don't want to do something that's not right, totally right for me, just because it happens to be the thing that I was planning to do. And so after Barry died, I did go ahead and teach for a year. People said, look, don't make any drastic changes in your life, just do what you'd always planned to do. So I started by teaching, but this sense within me continued to grow that I wanted to do something within the church or something in terms of missionary work or something. And then this job came up at Lowe Memorial as a youth director, and I just really sensed that was for me, that was right. So went and had a chat with the minister, and we have I've got a friend here, Joan from Lowe tonight, I see down at the back, and it was a wonderful time, I have to say. You know, the Lord restored a lot to me during those years, you know, after having been widowed, and the sadness of that, to then be around the young people and the joy of being with the youth, and they almost became like my family for a while, the children, you know, the young people. And God gave me a lot of joy during those years. Yeah.
And you got an opportunity, as the other photograph would suggest, that you went to Nigeria.
Yeah. I was trying to just think out some of the highlights from Lowe, and I suppose one was in particular going to Nigeria with Mission Africa, and we took some young people and adults together on the team, and it was a wonderful experience. I think that we learned more by going to Nigeria than we thought we were going to go, and, you know, help all these children who were very poor, and some of them being rejected by their families. And I'm sure we probably did hopefully bring them a bit of happiness, but I think they gave back to us so much. Could I just share one story from that trip?
Please.
When we arrived on the first night, it was very dark, no electricity. And I could hear this noise coming from one of the rooms. Now, the rooms had nothing in them apart from one dirty mattress, and about 25, 30 kids slept on this one dirty mattress. But from this room, I could hear the noise of like a drum beat and these children singing. These children had all been rejected by their families because their families thought that the children were possessed or had been the cause of a family member dying because of witchcraft. So the families had rejected the children. So the children were being kept in this sort of orphanage. But we could hear the children singing. And we went down to explore. And when we went into the room, there was a circle of the children singing praises to God, big, big smiles on their faces. And one of the children had a chair, like one of those chairs, turned back to front. And they were using it as a drum kit and hitting sticks off the chair. And it was amazing, having a full-on like worship session. But with no things, you know. And it was a real shock to see how... you come from such a materialistic part of the world to see how you don't need things to have the joy of the Lord and to be able to worship God. And so they taught us so much.
Wonderful experience.
It was, yeah.
You have a saint, or, you know, someone who spoke to you about where you were at that time too.
Mm. While I was at Lowe as youth pastor, a couple of people one day came up after the service and said, "Would you not consider being a minister, training for ministry?" And I immediately said, No, I wouldn't consider that. And in the car on the way home, I felt God sort of ask me, you know, say, "So why? What's the reason?" And I thought, because I'm a woman. And then again, I thought I heard the question, really? So I ended up, I had set aside 3 days to pray about something totally unrelated. But that 3 days, God started to use it in a different way, and it became something else. And the Bible passages were from Judges, and it was about Deborah. And I felt God speaking to me through Deborah and seeing Deborah's leadership and seeing how God was able to use Deborah and, you know, bring about peace in the land. And she was able to, she stood up and, you know, answered that call to be, she was a judge for the people, but she was also a prophetess. And I just thought it was amazing how God used her and that God wasn't prevented from using her because she was a woman. So then I started to reflect on other Bible passages and looking at the early church and the role of women in the early church. And so I felt God really shake things up in me, and the reasons I had been given in my head didn't really stand so much. So from that I knocked the door and went to Union Theological College to ask about, to inquire about applying for ministry, and the doors opened. So I sort of sensed that call into ministry from my time at Lowell. Yeah.
And that's a very young Karina here.
So I was licensed, and in the Presbyterian Church, when you're licensed, you can do weddings, but you can't actually do our sacraments, what we would term as sacraments, communion and baptism, until you're ordained. So while I was an assistant, I was in different placements. I was in Kilmachie, which is in Seymour Hill, and I was in Craiga on Craiga Presbyterian on the Craiga Road, and my longest placement was Cook Centenary and on the Ormer Road. So I studied for 4 years and then had about 6 years of an assistantship in Cook Centenary. So it was quite a long assistantship.
And did you keep the connection with Lowe going then?
We'd have visited, you know, from time to time. Yeah. But it's quite hard once you move on to another church and a placement. It's hard to keep up those connections. But also there was a new youth worker in post, and you sort of have to leave a wee bit of space for the new person to come in. Yeah. But there's always been friends that, you know, I'd see about and be very glad of the friendships in Lowe. Yeah.
I'm thinking about Lowe because you were telling me in some way about... And in fact, this is connected to our guest speaker last week, Father Martin O'Hagan, who was with us last week. And this is him along with his brother. and Father David DeLargy, the priest singing the Alleluia chorus. I play that because there's a connection between Handel's Messiah and your experience in Low. Is that right? Or am I wrong?
You're right. You're right.
I am right.
You're very right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You're very well prepared, Peter. The music and all is great.
Would this be the connection?
That would be the connection, yes.
Okay. Tell us about Handel's Messiah in Low.
So the minister, James Burnett, at that time, he was very keen on bringing in a whole orchestra, you know, for Handel's Messiah. And it was really a very big event. It was a wonderful event. And this particular cellist came a few years in a row, but I always tried to avoid him. Because somebody had said to me, oh, you two might be nice together. And I wasn't interested in meeting anybody, you know. So I'd avoided him for a few years. And then one year in particular, when he came, I had started to feel, as God was calling me into ministry, I also felt God wanting me to open up a bit more to the possibility of being in another relationship. And then Scott appeared at Handel's Messiah that Christmas. And I was up in the balcony, saw him playing the cello, and it was really amazing. And I was afraid to talk to him. So I waited up in the balcony till he left. So I didn't want to go near him. So after everything was over and everybody was leaving and he had gone, I came down the stairs, was heading down for tea and coffee in the hall. And he came back in. He'd been out at the car leaving his cello in, and came back in. We bumped into each other and couldn't avoid the conversation. So we got chatting and, yeah, I had one cello lesson. And the rest history. So, yeah.
How's your cello playing now?
Cobwebs all over the cello. Scott plays enough cello for both of us.
Right.
So,
okay.
So it was really nice to have, you know, a chance to be in another relationship and be with such a lovely person again. And I didn't think I'd meet anybody after Barry. It was a real blessing.
And,
yeah.
And this is the family. This is the family, yeah.
So when I met Scott, he was a single dad with four children. So the four older children in the picture, they were in their early teens. They were from the age 10 to about 14 when I met them. So I always say that when I met Scott, I fell in love with Scott, but I also fell in love with the kids. And because people would say, my goodness, like, how can you go from being a single person to like having, you know, a family of four? And because I was a youth worker, I said, it's just like having a really small youth group. It's fine. If they had been younger, you know, if they had been primary age, I wouldn't have known what to do with it. But because they were that age, I think that God had, you know, prepared me in a way for it. So, yeah, so had a wonderful, challenging time at times, but it was a wonderful privilege to be involved in the kids' lives as they were teenagers and as they grew through that stage. So we got married and then, yeah, and then had two wee ones after. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So this is two beautiful children.
So Levi and Ezra are the only two kids at home now. The others are up and away and living all over the world. But Levi and Ezra are at home and they really enjoy their big brothers and sisters coming back at Christmas or in the summer, and they get time together then. But yeah, Levi and Ezra have been brought so much joy. They're wee rascals, like, but they have brought a lot of joy. And I say, I didn't think I would ever meet anyone again, and I certainly didn't think I would ever have my own children. So being a stepmom and having these two has been a real blessing, yeah.
And what's the school run been like?
It's so easy. It's just like I walk around the corner. It's Dunmurry Primary, so it's it's been extremely handy.
It's good. It works out good.
It's been great, yeah.
Great. So this is the place that you call the office?
The office.
Kind of thing.
Yeah? Spiritual home, right? Yeah.
Isn't it? Really?
Yeah. Came to Dunmurry in 2017.
And the church itself was, it was built, what was it, 2011, was it?
I think it was 10. Angie, do you know? It was about 2010. Yeah, it was just before, it was when the previous minister was there. He was installed whenever the new building was opened, and he was there for about 6 years. And then I've been in Dunmurry now for about 6 years, yeah.
It's a beautiful space. Beautiful space.
It is. It's a wonderful building, and that's been the really nice thing. We haven't really had, and of course, you have some things with buildings you got to, you know, keep an eye on. But because it's so new, there's been relatively little. So we've been able to focus on building community rather than being focusing all our time on buildings. Yes. So that's been great.
Having the dock area, the coffee dock, the area for meetings and people coming together, must have been a great asset.
Yeah, I mean, so many people would say that in this new church building, it gives them a chance to mingle a lot more. It's a bit like what we've got here with the tables out tonight. It's just nice for community, isn't it? And to be able to chat to each other and get to know each other better. So that's been a real blessing, yeah. Yes.
Uh-huh. And I came in 2018, so and then 2020, we have COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah.
And, you know, this month, 3 years ago, we went into lockdown and everything closed, you know. How was that immediately for you? Because I remember, you know, our last celebration was on St. Patrick's Day in 2020, and most of you remember that. And that was a very emotional day for me. There was hardly a dry eye in our church because we didn't know when we would meet again. We didn't know when we would open, you know.
Yeah.
And yet it was so important, that connection, you know. How was it in Dunmurry Presbytery?
It was a massive shock, and it just felt very sad as well, because maybe a bit like you, but I would have gone into the church at times, into the sanctuary, and it was just empty and there was no one there, and we would have sometimes talked to God and just said, Lord, I'm so sad that I know that people can worship you from their homes, but I'm sad that we can't be together and worship you together. So it was a real loss. I think it was a time of real grief. But you just have to be very quick thinking and how you can somehow make those connections in other ways. And so we tried. I mean, you and I had many a chat about the IT side of things. And
well, I want to put it on record. It was about, we closed on the 17th of March. Probably about 2 weeks later, I called Karina to ask how she was and how it was going and how she was coping. And during one of those conversations, you mentioned that you were doing something on YouTube. And I said, what's YouTube? And you told me, you set it up, the channel. It's very easy to set up. And after that conversation, within 2 hours of that conversation, I had set up St. Anne's Dunmurry on YouTube. Because of this lady here. Because of Karina. And I was going to say the rest is history, but it's been a powerful journey for us in St. Anne's here, Karina, because of your suggestion. You know?
Oh, well, that's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Praise God.
You know, and, you know, so thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you for
challenging me and challenging us in so many ways. But the key to it was that word that you used, communication, keeping the communication going at that time.
Yeah, friendships were so important, weren't they, at that time? Yeah. And I think one of the things that we felt the need to do was to start a thing called the Dunmurry Joseph Project, which some of you may have heard of. And we wanted to try and be there and serve people, not just in the practical ways, but try and be there for people in terms of friendship and for prayer as well. And I have to say, the churches were such a wonderful support in coming together for the Joseph Project. And it was good to have the support of one another during that time with food banks. And I know each church was doing their own thing, but there was also some communication between churches too. And that was a great help to know that you're not alone in the area, you know, just doing your thing by yourself, but there's others together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, are you an expert in YouTube now?
Yeah. Angie could answer
Angie,
that.
Angie,
you know. I think I probably was close to an expert in YouTube during the part time of lockdown when we had to record our own videos. But now that it's gone to live stream, I think Angie's the expert and the team who look after the live stream are the experts now. I just get up and do my thing and they record it. So
But it's a great asset. It builds on what you already are doing there in Dunmurry. Last year, you had an opportunity to travel to the Holy Land.
Yes. So I've been part of an international relations panel through Church House, which is the central part of our church, the Presbyterian Church in Belfast. And on the international relations panel, we've been looking at the Middle East and specifically been thinking about the Israeli-Palestinian situation, which I'm sure you'll know from the news has been very tense, especially recently. We were meant to go the year that COVID happened, so the trip was delayed and we didn't get to go until last May, so almost a year now. And we went, we weren't going sightseeing, we went with the purpose of trying to understand the situation from the Palestinian perspective specifically, and we have since been trying to understand things more from the Israeli perspective as well. But the purpose of this trip was to go to a conference in Bethlehem Bible College called Christ at the Checkpoint. And I have to say that that week was really eye-opening. It was a very shocking week, and just trying to put ourselves in the shoes of the Christians in Bethlehem. It really affected all of us profoundly. Whenever we went there, we didn't realise that it was Israeli Flag Day on the Sunday, and Israeli Flag Day is a little bit like the 12th of July. So it was just the taxi driver told us on the way from the airport, he says, oh yeah, there'd be thousands of people coming and there'd probably be riots and stuff. And I was like, nobody told us, we didn't know. So we had planned to go travel from Bethlehem to Jerusalem on the Sunday, but we changed our plans because it was too tense. And it would have been on the news, you know, what was happening. There was lots of protests and riots and things. And the year before, it had led to the 11-day war. So there were fighter jets going overhead when we were there, and we just weren't sure what was going to happen. Thankfully, the situation didn't turn out as bad as the previous year. But it was still, very eye-opening seeing what things were like. There's just some photos there, would you like me to share a couple?
So
we visited a family who lived in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, and they were an Arab family, and they very often, they can't get building permits. They try hard to get building permits. This is what they told us. They try hard to get building permits. They try for years, spend a lot of money, and very often they're rejected. So often what happens is the Arab families would build their homes without building permits. And then what happens is you're then at the risk of the Israeli forces coming and knocking down your building. So this family had built a home, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, they got the knock on the door and were told to get out with the children and babies and everything. The parents sent the children to school, and while the children were at school, the house was totally demolished. And the family wanted to go in and get bits and pieces from the house, but were told they couldn't. So when the children came home from school, they were asking for their toys and things, and they were told, you know, it's in the rubble. It was extremely moving, and in seeing that and meeting the family and meeting the children and seeing the little toddlers and the babies, and they were actually, they live underneath the rubble. They've got one room that is still intact, and the rubble's all over the top of it. It's so dangerous. But they live in that one room, a big family. So we heard their story. We also went to the refugee camps, and this young lady was giving us a tour, and she was talking about the Nakba and the time that a lot of Palestinians had been forced to leave their homes. And this is a list of all the names of the different towns where people were forced to leave, and they're now living in refugee camps. But they have this dream that, you know, we will return, that someday they will return to their hometown. This is the checkpoint near in Bethlehem, near Rachel's tomb. And we went very early in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, and the crowds, like there was just hundreds of people trying to get to work. But from early, from like 4 o'clock in the morning on, there'd be thousands of mostly men queuing to get through to go to work on the other side. And the conference was in Bethlehem Bible College, and it's called Christ at the Checkpoint because it's like, how can you be Christ-like at the checkpoint, both for the Palestinians and for the Israelis? You know, how can you show Christ's presence in the midst of that very difficult situation? So yes, it was a very interesting time. Probably the thing that struck us the most was that there were South African theologians over, and they had lived through the apartheid in South Africa, and they said that the apartheid that they witnessed in Palestine was worse than what they went through in South Africa. And that was just shocking for us, because before that we had heard the word apartheid used, and we thought maybe it's a bit too strong to use that word. But whenever we heard the South Africans using it, we started to pay a little bit more attention. And since we've come back, we've had more conversations with the Jewish community and tried to understand things a bit more from Israeli perspective as well. So it's really been very informative.
And were they keen to hear of your situation here, coming from Northern Ireland and the journey from, 20 years ago, the Good Friday Agreement?
Do you know, we wondered that ourselves, that we thought that there could be more conversations, because there's probably stuff that we have learned. The situations are not exactly the same. There's lots of differences, but there are some things that we could share probably from our journey to be a support and a help. So yeah, we do think there's an opportunity for those conversations in the future. They didn't happen at that conference, but maybe in the future. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But from that visit, that has led to ongoing connections here locally with the Jewish community in particular.
Trying to understand both sides a bit better. But we're also looking at the wider Middle East, not just at the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Sure.
So it's very interesting. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to move you on to something else that is now dear to your heart.
Yeah, yeah. It is. That's right.
Oh. And that's food. It's dear to my heart too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've been on a journey with food too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I love food. I love, especially love like Indian food and Spanish food, tapas. And just love trying different foods. But about 3 years ago, Scott and I had been reading some books and just made the decision for different reasons. One of the reasons was to do with the environment, but for different reasons decided to change our diet and become vegan. So we have been vegan for 3 years now, and most of that time was at home, you know, during lockdown, and you can make your own food and it's no problem. But the challenge is when you go out to restaurants now, it's hard to find vegan food. It's getting easier, but I think there's still a bit of a journey to go until there's more vegan food. But
are you finding it difficult, is it just part of your nature now at this stage?
Yeah, no, I don't find it difficult now. Yeah. It was at the start, it was a wee bit tricky, but it's second nature now. It's just when you go out trying to navigate it in restaurants. Yeah.
Okay. Climate Sunday.
Yeah, so the Presbyterian Church in Ireland has been wanting to try and do, you know, something. It's recognised that, you know, being good stewards of God's creation is a very big part of our discipleship. So we have had a Climate Sunday where we've really focused on that. And also in our own church, we have started a creation care group, a small group, to think a little bit about creation care and stewardship. And yeah, it's something that has become increasingly important to me. And I believe that you're showing a film on Sunday.
Yes, our One World group, little bit of advertising.
Creative, yes, go for it.
On this Sunday coming at 3 o'clock, I think it is, Maria. The showing a film, the letter. And so it's all about caring for our common home, based on Pope Francis' encyclical Laudato Si, and his letter to others, an invitation to take care and be responsible for our common home. So that's happening this Sunday. Yes, absolutely.
Yes, so I think some of our group will hopefully come along if that's okay. Yeah,
absolutely. That's good. Of course, one of the places that you love and would love to visit is Spain.
Yeah. Yes, love.
And you love just Spain. Love the. What does that do when you hear that guitar?
I just want to go to Andalusia.
Yes.
It's lovely.
Yeah. It's beautiful. works wonders for you, Spain.
Yeah, well, the family that we do exchanges with, we just call them our Spanish family now, live in Lepe in Andalusia, and that's one of the children from the family who's now a grown man with me, and he taught me how to dance flamenco, so I love flamenco and salsa, and yeah, any chance I get to do a dance class when I can manage it, I enjoy it, so yeah.
We might get a wee, Jim, do you do salsa? Do you teach it? You don't teach salsa, whatever. No, it's strictly ballroom.
Very good.
Jim's teaches ballroom, you know.
Oh, wow.
So,
brilliant. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
So he does, yeah. But that's why we left that little bit of space in the front here. You know, just in case, you know. Yeah. Okay, this is another good friend of yours here, right? Yes.
Yeah, well, when we're on hobbies and people here important to us, I have to include our little dog Buttons. We got Buttons during lockdown, and she's almost two now, and I have to say she's been such a blessing. As Angie knows, I wasn't a doggy person until I got Buttons, but I'm definitely a doggy person now, and she has just been such a blessing. I think it's just, you know, the way they just follow you around and they're always there. I felt at the start that was quite shocking for me. I wasn't used to someone following me around all the time, but I just thought, you know, it's just like she just reminded me of God's presence. God's always with us, and you know, he doesn't get bored of us. You know, God is with us all the time, and I would suffer from migraine, and there have been times that I've had migraine, and she's just been there with me, and so she's been a real wee therapy dog too. She's been brilliant, and I just love going out for walks with her, and it gives me a chance to get my head cleared as well. She takes me for the walks, not in the sense that she pulls me, but in the sense that I feel it does my mental health good to get out for a walk and just spend time with her. So she's been a real blessing.
Dogs do that.
Yeah.
I was blessed with a dog for 16 years.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. And that's what Sam, my dog, spelled P-S-A-L-M.
Ah, oh, that's very good.
Well, a priest dog called Sam, that's how you spell it. Yeah.
Yeah,
but Sam is Sam for 16 years, and rain, hail, sleet or snow, twice a day. Absolutely.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Clear the head. Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Wonderful
so
gift.
Good.
Yeah. I asked you about, you know, maybe movies and kind of things that are kind of special too. And I was thinking, we had a piece from the mission last week with Father Martin.
Oh, is that right?
Uh-huh. True.
It's beautiful. Music's gorgeous in that film, isn't it?
And that's a particularly piece of music that takes you somewhere else. Allows your imagination to travel.
Absolutely, yeah. We used Gabriel's oboe when Scott and I got married. That was the piece of music that we played.
Yes.
You know, it's gorgeous, yeah.
And then...
And I like the other thing I like about the mission was the theme, really, you know, to do with the theology of war. And, you know, thinking about, like, what do you do? Do you fight, or do you be the one who turns the other cheek? And the two priests demonstrating the two different positions is something that I've always kind of thought a lot about, you know. Who was reflecting Christ more, the one who was defending and protecting, or the one who was, you know, turning the other cheek and leading the way with the cross?
Yes, wonderful, yeah. And the whole struggle with the indigenous people and these... blow-ins.
The injustice of it.
The injustice of that, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
You know? And Christ in the middle of that.
Yeah.
And Christ working with the poor and those who are struggling, you know?
That's it, yeah.
And then, of course, the other one is The Sound of Music. And that was it. Here you are on the hills. You're singing your heart out. I can just see you, Karina.
I always dreamt of being in the Sound of Music, you know.
Yes.
It's about to sing there.
Yes.
What
was it captured you?
I think as a child, just watching it, I just loved the music, and I just thought, when I grow up, I'm going to be in the Sound of Music. And after I got to a certain age, I thought, that's not going to happen. But, No, yes. I really loved it. I love, and as an adult, I love the themes in it, you know, and, you know, seeing Captain Von Trapp, you know, he didn't want to live again after his wife had died, and, you know, but then he learned to appreciate the joy of music again and learned to live again, and then the way he wasn't going to just, you know, give in and take up that position, you know, within the Nazi regime, but he stood his ground and had integrity, and he and the family managed to escape. So yeah, I think big themes in there, and yes. I've watched it recently with our children, and they have enjoyed it. So
yeah, wonderful. And it's celebrating what, 50 years? It's just over 50 years, whatever, yeah. You know.
Mm.
Okay. Two books that you mentioned here,
yes,
both by Margaret Atwood. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, first of all, I should say that I don't read fiction very often because I do a lot of reading for ministry. And so these are probably the two books I've read or been reading the most recently. So I thought I'd share those with you. Margaret Atwood, The Handmaid's Tale. It's a dystopian story. It's meant to be like imagining if some of the things that we might have wrong with our society, imagine if they were exaggerated and became a lot worse. And if we continued on a trajectory that, you know, we ended up, for example, in a totalitarian regime, what it could look like. And so this Republic of Gilead takes over the United States government and sets up a totalitarian regime. And religion is used as a way of control, especially controlling the women. And some women are used as handmaids to provide children for the families of commanders. And Margaret Atwood said when she was writing the book that she didn't include anything in it that hadn't already happened somewhere in the world at some point in history. So when you're reading it, you know, we can think, oh, that would never happen. They think, you know, it has actually, these things have already happened at some point in history somewhere in the world. So yeah, it's been quite a shocking read, but it's also very inspiring to see how the women not only survive but try to resist within that situation, and how people try to make changes, but also to see the dangers of spiritual abuse, how, you know, Bible verses can be taken out of context and sometimes used to control and to uphold unhealthy systems. And I think we have to, as Christians, have to reflect on, you know, are we using scripture in a way that God intended it, or are we using it just to back up our own agendas? So it's given me a lot of food for thought. But it is quite a dark book, so just a wee warning there. It's not a light bedtime read.
Okay. I'm a bit like yourself. Most of my reading, nearly all of my reading, is for work. If you like, to do with ministry, to do with liturgy. So I really only read when I'm away on holiday. It's crime. It's detective novels.
Oh, it's crime.
Novels, you
okay,
know.
For you.
Fast moving crime. You
yes,
know, I love that.
So
that's my outlet.
Yeah.
Just on holiday. Mm-hmm. I can't settle at home to read like that.
Yeah.
Too much, you know. I need to be out of the situation. So there's, you know, so there's a
yeah.
there's a likeness there too. You also mentioned a book there.
Well, I thought I would throw in a Christian
yes.
book as well. Just so you don't think I'm totally secular. Yes, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality is a book that we've been reading recently in church. Well, I've been preaching on it. I'm using it for a series. And it's really been, it's a book that tries to help you go a little bit deeper in your faith. It uses the iceberg as an illustration that many of us, you know, may just have this facade of, you know, living the Christian life forever. But if we go deep down, are we allowing God into our lives in the deepest part of our lives to change us, to transform us? So it's about being more honest with ourselves, being honest with God, and being more honest with each other, and trying to have healthy relationships. So actually preparing, reading this book and preparing for the talks over the last few weeks has, I think God's been using it to challenge me on things as well. So yeah, that's, I would recommend that one.
Okay, well, I think I'll get a note of that and cover that. That sounds good. Tell me, Karina, you talked about salsa and flamingo and Spanish tapas that have to be vegan nowadays,
yeah.
And on holidays in Spain, and cooking at home during lockdown, and going walks with the dog.
Mm.
Do you do gardening?
No, have you seen the front of our house? I'm always embarrassed because it's we're always like needing the grass cut or something.
Yes.
I would love to be. I would love to be into gardening, but no, I'm not.
What do you like at hanging curtains?
Are you trying to get me to do something?
No. I want to. I was really trying to boast about the curtains we hung just a couple of weeks ago.
I was
assistant to Martin, who's up there. See, underneath that curtain up there. Martin is our professional curtain hanger.
Very good.
And I was his assistant. I was his gopher. And, you know.
That's a good job. They're beautiful.
And but that's something I find myself. Every time I move house, I've got to put up curtains. Or I've got to pick carpet. I've got to select a colour paint.
Do you do
any painting, decorating?
Yes, well, I do, yeah. Because we've had to, our own home, you know, we've had to get it ready to rent it out. So, and I really enjoy that. I love refurbishing and taking something that's, you know, looks quite old and dilapidated and making it into something beautiful. So I really enjoy that, actually.
Upcycling.
Yes.
Upcycling.
Yes, I enjoy
reusing it in a new way.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
What do you like at recycling? The ordinary stuff at home? You know, the blue bin, the black bin, the wee brown bin, and the bottle bank. Yeah.
We do our best. Yeah. We certainly do, yeah.
Are you like me? Do you sneak to the bottle bank when it's quiet? When there's nothing about? You know?
I think Scott might, but not me.
Okay. Yeah. I drive round to the bottle bank. Margaret gets out with the bottles. I don't get out. She puts the bottles in, you know.
Don't go with your collar on. No,
when it's quiet. Yeah. It's holy water bottles, of course.
Of course.
I was trying to think of something else I was going to ask you. What
was it to do with the environment? Maybe I told you that we've been trying, Scott and I have been trying to cut down on plastics a bit. So one of the things we've been trying to do was making our own shampoo bars instead of, you know, buying a bottle of shampoo.
Yeah.
But we haven't mastered it yet. So if you see us with really greasy looking hair, that's why. Okay. We haven't quite got the formula right yet.
Okay, so I'm interested in that because, you know, when you get to near the end of a bar of soap, it's so small.
Yes.
I use a bar of soap in the shower. It gets so small, you can't use it. So I was saving them up and I trying to try and work out, what do I do with this? And I bought this little Hessian bag to put them in.
Yeah.
And I thought I could use it if they're in the little bag.
That's
but
a good idea.
I find that very difficult. So I'm looking for ideas.
Well, you can also melt down. I can't believe we're talking about this now, but you know, like you melt chocolate and like with the glass bowl and the pot of water, you can melt down your soap ends together and mix them all together and then pour them into a mould and make yourself a new bar of soap.
A new bar. I'm going to do that. So that would be a special pot set aside for soap.
No, just a normal pot filled with water with a glass bowl and you melt down your soap on the top in the bowl. Like as if you're making chocolate, you know.
Right. It doesn't ruin the pot, no?
No, it's in the glass bowl, so it wouldn't ruin the pot. No. There you go.
I was just thinking because as a child we grew up boiling handkerchiefs and there was a pot that was always used.
Sorry,
you know, for boiling things. And you certainly wouldn't have cooked food in it. afterwards, you know, it was a special pot for that. You know?
That's
what I was thinking of. But it's okay. I'm going to take that off.
There
Absolutely.
We go.
Margaret, keep those soap. No, I'll take it off. Yeah, okay. You get me the pot.
If you crack the formula, you can let us know.
Yeah. You suggested that we looked at a little YouTube video here of a particular hymn.
Yes.
Song.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah. It's based on Psalm 23, and it was the song that really spoke to me, especially after Barry passed away. And it's probably the part of the song that speaks to me the most is, "You mourn with me and you dance with me, for my heart of hearts is bound to you." And I just thought that it was just so beautiful, you know, that God is with us through the really difficult times, but also through the enjoyable times in life as well. And God's heart is bound to ours. So it's a very special song to me.
I won't close again. Jesus, guide my way. Oh, you mourn with me and you dance with me, for my heart of hearts is bound to you. Though I walk through valleys low, I'll feel no evil. On the water still my soul, my heart will trust in you. My heart will trust in you.
Thank you very much indeed, Kavita, for that, for sharing that, and the words, the word that came across that seemed to speak about everything that you've wonderfully shared with us this evening is that word of trust.
Yeah.
Trusting in God. Mm. You know, trusting in God who's in the middle of whatever is happening in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that trusting in God as you went through college and university and meeting Barry, you know, and that journey with Barry, and then trying to discover where you need to be after that.
Yeah.
Trusting that God's in that some way or other, you know, through all the different people that you meet.
Yeah. That's it. I remember one day sitting on the bedroom floor and thinking, I am in the deepest pit. I can't go any deeper. This is like the lowest I've ever been. But in that moment, I just sensed that God was saying that His arms go even deeper, and no matter, you know, what our deepest point is, God's there with us, and His love is deeper, and He will sit with us in that pit, and He will help us up. So that song just brings it all back to me. God's faithfulness.
Well, I think that's what you have gifted us with tonight here. You've taught us, in so many ways tonight about that we need to trust more that God is with us, that he's shaping us, that he's moulding us, that he's calling us. And all we have to do is open ourselves to that God and allow him to do the moulding, allow him to do the shaping, allow him to do the work, allow God to be God.
Absolutely.
Karina, it's been a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this moment.
Well, thank you
very much. I've enjoyed others earwigging to us, listening. And thank you for sharing your story of life, of love, of faith, of trust in God.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being our friend.
Thank you.
Thank you for being my friend.
Thanks.
Thank you for all that you do here in this Dunmurry area. Thank you very much indeed, Karina.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And we have to get our own back and invite Father Peter to come and do the same for us.
And a little advert, in the Church Green in Dunmurry on Easter Sunday, our dawn service at 7 o'clock in the morning. So, and everybody's welcome to come to that. What can I say? Next week, our guest in conversation with me is Professor Sir Michael McBride. We know him as the Chief Medical Officer here in Northern Ireland, and we've seen him on our screens right through the pandemic, and we've listened to him, and we listened to him being interviewed and answering difficult questions and giving difficult advice, but always being there for us. And it's a great privilege that Professor Sir Michael McBride will be with us next Tuesday. I just can't wait to hear his story, and I think it's going to be wonderful. So please come back, tell your friends about it as well. And can I remind you also that our three previous conversations, guests, there's a recording of that conversation on our parish website, and hopefully we'll be able to upload our conversation tonight as well on our website so that others can listen in wherever they are. So, Karina, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much.
Wish you every blessing. Thank you very much.